There's been a big expansion in craft brewing and craft winemaking in the country over the past decade, but craft whiskey is also seeing growth, with the number of small distilleries more than doubling over the past few years. I'm Jim Meadows, and today on Focus, we'll talk with whiskey expert Clay Risen. He says these small distilleries are rebuilding America's reputation for quality whiskey. At least 17 craft distilleries are located in Illinois. And in the second half of Focus today, we'll meet people from two of them, Ernie Trinkle of Rumshine Distilling in Tilton and Jesse Williams of J.K. Williams Distilling in East Peoria. Focus continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. If you like whiskey, this is a good time to be an American. Or, so say my guests today. Later in the program, we'll talk to folks from two fairly new Central Illinois craft distilleries, Rumshine in Tilton, that's near Danville, and J.K. Williams in East Peoria. Right now, let's meet a man who's made it his mission to keep track of the USA's growing field of whiskey products. Clay Risen is an editor with the op-ed section of the New York Times. He's the author of A Nation on Fire, America in the Wake of the King Assassination, and most recently, he's written American Whiskey, Bourbon, and Rye, a guide to the nation's favorite spirit, including profiles, ratings, and tasting notes for more than 200 whiskeys. It's published by Sterling Epicure. And Clay Risen, welcome to Focus.
Well, thanks for having me.
And just a note, if you appreciate whiskey and have opinions about your favorites, or if you're just curious about the subject, we welcome your calls and emails on Focus today. Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455 or send an email to will-talk@illinois.edu. Phone number again, 1-800-222-WILL. Besides a phone or email, you can send them to us on Twitter or Facebook at Focus580. Clay, first of all, some guidance for the uninitiated. And we did a show a few months ago about craft wineries and vineyards in Illinois, but wine and beer, for that matter, is not the same as whiskey as far as, you know, I guess, how you drink it.
That's right. You wouldn't want to drink nearly as much whiskey as you do beer or wine in a sitting. It's a much higher proof and is really for sipping or mixing into a cocktail.
Well, what do you like about whiskey? What makes it special?
Well, for me, first of all, I just like the flavor. I think it's got a nice, particularly if you look at the whole range of whiskeys that are out there, from Scotch and there's some wonderful Japanese whiskeys, but even within the United States, you have a whole range of flavors, sweet and smoky and char and floral, and so it's always interesting to try a new one. But I also think it's a very diverse liquor. You can, like I said, you can mix it into cocktails, you can drink it straight, you can have it on the rocks. It just works in a variety of settings. You pair it with foods very well. It's great for dessert. So it's just a fun spirit to encounter and explore.
Your book reviews over 200 whiskeys, including two brands in Illinois from the Koval Distillery and Few Spirits, or FEW. How much of the industry do you cover in this book?
Well, I try to cover as much as I can. It's not literally comprehensive. There are a number of brands that, for one reason or another, didn't make it into the book. To be honest, it would be unwieldy at this point to include everything. But I tried to give a range so that the average consumer in the average city in America can walk into a liquor store and more or less find everything that's on the shelf in the book.
And I wanted to ask you just a couple of questions about the history of the drink. One thing I had been aware of, especially because I lived in Peoria for several years, is that Peoria was a huge whiskey town in the 19th century, and there was actually a whiskey trust in the late 19th century based in Peoria that once sought to, I guess, control all the whiskey production and distribution in the country.
Right. At one point, they controlled about 95% of all whiskey production by volume in the country. And also what's interesting is because excise taxes on liquor production provided the federal government with an enormous amount of revenue. This was before the income tax. They actually gave, the Whiskey Trust was responsible for almost half of that income, which means that Peoria, the tax district for Peoria, which is a little larger than the city, provided almost half of all the money the federal government took in in the late 19th century. But yeah, even today, if you go around Peoria, and I've been recently, you can still find evidence, if you know where to look, of what used to be. There's one of the nicknames for, or one of the names for unaged whiskey was called high wine. And there's a district in Peoria on a bluff overlooking downtown called the High Wines District. And I don't know how many people know that legacy, but that's where that name comes from.
And that's actually, I think, this, particularly the streets of High Street and Moss Avenue. I lived on Moss Avenue for a time in the 1980s, perhaps under much humbler circumstances than some of the whiskey barons of the time.
A lot of their mansions are still there, but they've been carved up into apartment buildings.
Yes, that is the case. And I'm wondering, especially with all that happened with Prohibition, et cetera, is there any link between the whiskey production then and any whiskey production today?
Well, there is, in the sense that the Whiskey Trust was hit by the federal government with antitrust litigation, and it went through a number of different iterations. It eventually became a company called National Distillers, which, after Prohibition, bought up a lot of the other sort of brands that had gone dark during Prohibition. And National, through a variety of sort of generations, became what we know now as Jim Beam. So in a way, Jim Beam is sort of a descendant of, or Beam Incorporated is a descendant of the Whiskey Trust. But don't blame them for any any of the malfeasance that the trust undertook.
Beam Incorporated, I understand, is based in the Chicago area, but they don't produce in Illinois, do they?
No, they don't. They do all of their production, all of their whiskey production in Kentucky.
Now, I was always confused when I came to Peoria in 78. The Hiram Walker Distillery was still around.
That's right.
It's now, I believe, an ADM facility that makes ethanol, though I heard they make alcohol for vodka as well. What happened to Hiram Walker?
Well, Hiram Walker, just like a lot of other distilleries, just was hit by declining demand for whiskey through the 70s. People were gravitating toward more lighter spirits, unaged spirits, tequila, vodka, obviously, was the big thing. White wine became huge in the 70s, and whiskey just wasn't cool. This was what the baby boomers were reacting against what their parents drank, and so Hiram Walker, like dozens of other famous brands back then or famous distilleries, eventually had to shut their doors. Now Hiram Walker still is a very powerful brand in Canada. But their U.S. operations are no more.
And that's why it's not in your book, which focuses on U.S. whiskey.
Exactly.
And you were talking about the decline. With the decline in popularity in the late 20th century, was there a decline in American whiskey quality as well?
Yes, and what's funny is that there is actually a lot of very good American whiskey that was sitting around. If you don't take it out of a barrel, it continues to age. So you had, in the 80s and through the 90s, some very old, very high-quality whiskey. But what companies were doing, they realized they couldn't sell it for a profit. So what they did was they took this high-quality, very tasty whiskey and they would blend it with neutral spirits to make it go further, right? And they would sell it as a down-market brand. So things that would, in their sort of pure form, retail for very high dollar values were suddenly being sold as plonk, and that reinforced the image of whiskey as a down market sort of skid row kind of drink,
rot gut, that sort of thing.
Exactly. But behind it all, there really was good stuff. And today, what you're seeing with some of the really really high end whiskeys, the stuff that's aged for 20 years, well, that's the remainder of that stock. Pappy Van Winkle is one of those that they just were smart enough to keep around.
Well, so what happened to create the upsurge, the resurgence of American whiskey?
Well, it's a good question. A couple of things. I think, first of all, there was a decision in the 80s by a number of distillers to try to reverse that image and to start to produce high-end American whiskeys. So in 1984, a distiller named Elmer T. Lee, who was with what is now called Buffalo Trace, introduced a whiskey called Blanton's, was a single barrel. It was, you know, each bottle came, the whiskey in each bottle came from a single barrel, so it was a statement of quality. And it sort of lined up with the single malt scotch trend that was emerging. This was kind of their answer to single malt scotch. So a lot of other distilleries rolled out the same sort of thing. Woodford, Jim Beam started rolling out some small batch single barrel products. But that was really just kind of priming the scene, because it took a long time for people to turn to these whiskeys. And what happened, I think, was just a generational change. The children of the baby boomers started to reach drinking age in the 2000s, and there was a general turn toward American-made local products. I mean, you see this obviously across the range of consumer goods, but particularly in food and dining. People want authenticity. They want something local. Whiskey is that. They want something with a history. American whiskey has great history. They want something that has a diverse range of flavors and is interesting to explore. Vodka can be a great drink, but it is what it is. It's a flavorless, clear product. Whiskey is a lot of different things.
So whiskey, you can go a lot of places with it,
right,
as far as
exactly
being creative with the flavor if you know what you're doing.
Exactly. It helps a lot that today an army of celebrity chefs, they all love whiskey, and they're all talking about it, and they're proselytizing it on their shows, in their restaurants. They include whiskey menus in their restaurants, and that filters down through the population. So I think that you just see this general trend that makes whiskey the obvious drink of choice for a lot of people.
Let's go ahead and take a phone call. This is line one. Kent from Champaign has a question. Good morning.
Good morning. When I was in my younger adult life and still living in Kansas, I used to buy a product called Southern Pride, which apparently was distilled in Pekin, Illinois.
Uh-huh.
It was a very smooth sipping whiskey, nothing like White Lightning. It was a corn whiskey, nothing like White Lightning or Moonshine. I wonder if you know anything about it.
I don't know Southern Pride. There were a number of distilleries. You know, the Peoria area had a number of distilleries.
I know there is an ethanol plant in Peoria today, and its ancestor was the old Corn Products company, and I was wondering if the ancestor of that, because Corn Products, I think, was not into making spirits, but perhaps years earlier they were making some. Maybe they were making whiskey from corn.
That very well could be. You know, during the 70s and 80s, there were just countless brands that went defunct, and actually today are being bought up and reintroduced. The Michter's brand, for example, was around in up through the late 70s, and it disappeared. And then a decade or so ago, another company came in, and they didn't even have to pay for it. It was an abandoned brand, and so they started creating a new line called Michter's. Now, Michter's today is not related to the old Michter's, except by name. But you're seeing that more and more, and I wouldn't be surprised if someone came along and created a new Southern Pride whiskey.
Kent, how far back were you drinking Southern Pride? What decade would that be?
This would have been about in the probably the 70s. I still have two lonely bottles left, small bottles, in my downstairs closet, and someday I guess I'll drink them and then they'll be all gone.
I'll tell you what, there is a huge market today there's almost an archaeological project going on. People go to old liquor stores, they go to their parents' liquor cabinets or their basements, and they look for these old bottles called dusty hunting. And, Ken, I wouldn't recommend you do this, because that's probably some good whiskey you want to drink there yourself, but I would not be surprised if you could sell that for a decent coin. But I never recommend anyone invest in whiskey. It's much too fun to drink.
I didn't even know that a private person could sell
whiskey. Well, yeah, you can. Sorry, let me backtrack. You can't sell it directly to somebody. You can auction it. You can sell it. You can do it through an auction house. Yes, I don't advise that you sell it to anyone individually.
Okay, thank you. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you very much, Kent. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We're talking about the resurgence of whiskey in America with Clay Risen. He's the author of American Whiskey, Bourbon, and Rye, A Guide to the Nation's Favorite Spirit. It's published by Sterling Epicure. Join the discussion at 1-800-222-9455 or send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 1-800-222-WYLL. And besides phone or email, you can send your question to us on Twitter or Facebook at Focus580. And, you know, for people who are really starting from square one, what is it about whiskey, maybe about the production process? What is key to making whiskey whiskey?
Well, the first thing is that it's distilled. And I would actually step back even a step further. It has to be made from grain. So you can't, for example, take potatoes, which you use to make vodka. So it has to be a grain. It has to be wheat, corn, barley, rye. There are actually some pretty obscure grains out there that some craft distillers are using, millet, spelt, things like that.
Can rice produce a whiskey?
Rice can produce not great. I've yet to try a rice whiskey that was any good. But Koval up in Chicago that you mentioned, they do some really interesting sort of obscure grain whiskeys. And, you know, they're not for everybody, but they're very well made. And I encourage people to try those if they're in the area. But then you take that and you basically make a beer out of it. You add yeast. You let it, you know, sort of you create a mash out of the grain, and then you let yeast take the starches in there and turn them into and the sugars and turn them into alcohol, and then that's your beer basically. And then you distill that, and that draws the alcohol out of the mash. And you do that a few times, and you create a product that is still has some of the essence of that grain, but is, you know, primarily alcohol and water. And then with whiskey, typically you stick it in a barrel, and this is really where you know the magic happens. Is the barrel? If you usually barrels are toasted inside, they put a flame inside to kind of char it a little bit and bring some of the sugars that are in the wood to the surface, and then you put the whiskey in there, and over time, the whiskey, the various compounds and chemicals in the whiskey, and various compounds in the wood interact, and some of it's drawn out. People have probably heard of the angel share, which is the amount of alcohol that every year, usually about 4% every year, just evaporates through the wood. The wood is porous, and you know, it doesn't leak out, but it evaporates. And then you have, but you have things coming in and going out of the wood, and the wood is sort of a sponge in a way. And you let it sit long enough, and it takes on a color and it takes on a flavor that is complementary to what was there to begin with. So you still have, when you take it out, some of those underlying grain notes, but they've also been transformed and added to by what was in the barrel.
How long is the aging process?
Well, some people age it for very short periods of time. You see craft distillers who do it for just a few months. You see some that are aged for 20 years. And I would say, if you ask sort of the old bourbon hands, they would say it takes, you know, about 4 years at least to get a good bourbon. But it also varies depending on where you are in the country or where you are in the world. One of the reasons Scotch tends to be older, one of a variety of reasons, is that the temperatures there are pretty stable. And so you don't have a fluctuation that makes the barrel expand and contract and pull in and expel the water. In Kentucky, you have very warm summers up to above 100 degrees and extremely cold winters, you know, often below freezing for long periods of time. And so that forces the barrels, which sit in unheated warehouses, to expand and contract, and that action makes the whiskey age faster. So you can imagine if you're in some place like Kentucky, somewhere with a hot climate or a humid climate, or somewhere with a very cold climate, you're going to get very different products with the same aging time. And that, I think, is another thing that's very interesting about whiskey, is a Tennessee whiskey and a Maine whiskey are going to taste different for that reason.
And this is part of, I guess, the craft of the distiller is how to work that process.
Precisely. And what's interesting too is, you know, a barrel could taste great at 4 years and then horrible at 5 years and then wonderful again at 6 years, because there's this constant chemical interaction going on. And so you're absolutely right. It's the art of the distiller to take samples from each barrel every year or every, you know, fairly regularly, different ones do it at different intervals, and to figure out what's the the right time to pull out that barrel. And different barrels in different parts of the warehouse are going to age at different speeds because, you know, one that's next to the wall is going to be more affected by outside temperatures than one that's in the middle. And heat rises, the ones that are up at the top will age faster than the ones at the bottom. And so the other art of the distiller is to know how to take all of these different barrels and combine them in a way that produces a whiskey that is consistently more or less the same in terms of flavor and smell and general profile.
Now, there is some whiskey. You make a point of noting that your book does not include whiskey that is not aged.
Right, right. And white goes under a variety of names, white whiskey, moonshine, white dog, new make. These drinks, some of them are very good, but it's also, I believe it's kind of a fad, and right now everyone's making it, but over time it'll end up being a fairly niche market. So you know, for me, in terms of just deciding what to cover and what not to cover, I thought, yeah, that's some place that I can make a cut. But there are people who enjoy it, that's the wonderful thing about whiskey is there's probably something out there for everyone.
Flavored whiskeys is also not in the book?
No, flavored whiskeys are not also. I tend to see those more as, not a niche product. They're huge right now. They're incredibly popular. I don't know if they're necessarily a trend. I think they're probably here to stay. But they also tend to, put it this way. If you know you want a cinnamon-flavored whiskey, then you can go find a cinnamon flavored whiskey, and there's not a whole lot I can tell you in terms of the nuances of it. They tend not to be particularly nuanced. They taste like whiskey with cinnamon or honey or cherry flavored. They're almost more like they're not pre-made cocktails, but they're kind of like that. So I figured that was another thing that I could sort of safely leave out, and people wouldn't come asking.
Well, that brings up, to your job in the book is that you have to rate and then describe these whiskeys. And there's over 200 here.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty sure you didn't do it in one sitting.
No. No. That would be tough. I had a tasting panel, and we met.
So it's not just you yourself.
Well, no, I'm sort of the captain of
of
the process, and so I had a tasting panel. We had a consistent set of we had a review sheet and went through a series of whiskeys every night. We met about once or twice a week, and we would then take all that information, compile it, and I would use that as sort of source material along with the whiskeys themselves. I went back and tried, and just to come up with a general idea, because it's also true that there are some people who have amazing palates and can just, with almost scientific accuracy, tell you what flavors are in a whiskey. But ultimately, it's really a subjective experience, and so it was important for me to say, well, just because I find certain qualities in a whiskey, I'd like to know that other people might find something different. And also, if I like something and no one else does, well, that I need to take that into account.
Well, I think there were two Illinois distilleries that you mentioned in the book, and I'm looking at the one you're listing for Koval, and just give an idea of how you put down the information. This is Koval Single Barrel Rye Whiskey, rated 2 stars.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing is nose, which is interesting thought to me. Floral, dark, funky. But what do you mean by nose?
Well, nose is just the smell.
Mm-hmm.
It's just what it smells like. And usually that's the first way you want to encounter a whiskey. Maybe you want to look at it first and see what kind of color it is. But really, and the color can sometimes give you a sense of what it's going to. If it's dark, it's probably going to have some rich flavors. Mm-hmm. If it's light, it's probably a light-flavored whiskey.
Yeah, the color here is pale straw. The body is light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's one of the things that's interesting about a rye whiskey is that the color is a little different than what you would expect out of a bourbon. A rye whiskey can still have some of that dark funk to it and nevertheless be light in color and light in body. But that's kind of it. So you take a whiff of it and let the aromas sort of rise up into your nose. You don't want to smell too aggressively because sometimes the alcohol can really singe the nostrils. And But that's kind of how you experience, and usually want to let your mouth stay open so that you get a nice sort of course of air current through your nasal passage, and just that lets you feel the whole thing.
And the final conclusion, I guess the general description for this particular brand of Koval, is a good display of the rye spirit, overall a very well-made rye whiskey. Mm-hmm. Is that was sort of the consensus of the panel?
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, one of the things about Koval, and I mentioned them before, is that they do, they are able to reduce a grain or to produce a whiskey that is the pure expression of the grain. And so I think that, you know, this is, if you taste their single barrel rye, that is, to me, what, you know, it's just a very well done, it may not even be a typical rye whiskey, but it is what the rye spirit should taste like. You know, and like you said, it's a 2-star, but in the book, that's, you know, 2 out of 4. I'm a pretty hard grader. So that's a very good grade. And it's a great accomplishment on their part.
Now, of course, you know, Koval and FEW are new to me, but there are some very familiar brands in the book. In your experience, have you found that you're likely to find a good whiskey among the smaller, the craft distilleries as among the big ones? Or?
Well, you know, the thing with craft, and I think people have to take this into account when they're exploring craft whiskey, is it's like any industry where there's a lot of startups. Most of them are going to fail because they don't make a good product, they're not managed well, they don't have the talent either at the still or at the accounting book to make it a working concern. And that's just business. These are businesses. And so I always have to say that because there are a lot of people who you know, believe in craft as almost as an ideology. And I love craft whiskeys. I think there's some wonderful ones out there. But it's much more I don't want to say hit or miss, but you're going to have a lot of whiskeys that just aren't quite right, but also a lot of whiskeys that are revelations. And I would say, you know, Koval for me was one where I was just blown away by their willingness to experiment, their ability to create these sort of pure essences of grain whiskeys. And that's a lot of fun. The level of innovation that we're seeing in craft whiskey is just phenomenal, and it's making the whole category a real delight to be writing about and exploring.
I have a question that was emailed in about American whiskey. Mike wants to know, can you address the difference in taste between American and Canadian whiskey? Mike writes, I must admit, I prefer Crown Royal and the like, as I find bourbon to have an odd aftertaste. What accounts for the difference?
Well, first of all, it's just the individual. I would say in terms of preferences. But in terms of what you're looking at in flavors, you know, most Canadian whiskeys, and there's variety here, but most Canadian whiskeys are they're distilled and aged pure grain products, right? So a pure 100% rye, that's the only grain they use. And there might be 100% wheat that they use as well. And then they'll, after all of that, they'll blend it together. And usually they'll blend in some neutral spirits as well to give it that lighter flavor. So that's what you're getting out of a Canadian whiskey primarily. An American whiskey is different in that everything is blended together beforehand, before the distillation and before the aging. So you get a different product. Now, Canadians tend to be lighter. They tend to be, their critics say they tend to be a little bland, a little uninteresting. Their fans say that they tend to be more approachable and more fun to drink. And I think that's probably, you know, where Mike is coming from, in that bourbon does tend to be somewhat more aggressive and more robust spirit. And, you know, each their own.
Well, you're making it sound like this is a good time to be drinking American whiskey.
It absolutely is. It's the best time.
Well, Clay Risen, thank you for joining us on Focus Today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Clay Risen is a New York Times op-ed editor and the author of American Whiskey, Bourbon, and Rye, A Guide to the Nation's Favorite Spirit. It's published by Sterling Epicure. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk with distillers from 2 new whiskey producers in central Illinois, so new I don't think they were open when Mr. Risen was researching his book. This is Focus on WYLL. We are back on Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows, and we are looking at the world of whiskey, American whiskey, and the growth of craft whiskey production in this country over the past few years. Thanks again to whiskey expert Clay Risen for joining us the first half of the show. Now let's talk to a couple of folks who make the product. With me in the studio is Ernie Trinkle. His business partner, Tyler Langston, is also here. Together, they opened Rubenshine Distilling in Tilton in Vermilion County last October. Ernie, welcome to Focus.
Thank you.
And on the phone is Jesse Williams, master distiller at J.K. Williams Distilling, which also opened last October in East Peoria. Jesse runs the business with his wife, Cassie, his brother, John Williams, and John's wife, Kristen. Jesse, welcome to Focus.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
And your questions about whiskey are welcome at 1-800-222-9455. If you want to know how it's made, well, we have two people here who make it. Give us a call or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. The phone number, again, is 1-800-222-WILL. And, Ernie, I wonder if I can start with you. How did you get started making whiskey? This is not the simplest hobby in the world.
Well, I had a neighbor, and he kept talking about doing it. And one day I did some research on it, and then I started doing it about 2006. And then I researched some recipes, and it turned out to be pretty good. So I just went from there.
And at what point did the two of you think, well, this could be a business, you could actually be making this and selling it?
About 2 years ago, we got together, and he tried it, and we talked about it, and we're both contractors. And the village of Tilton was nice enough to give us land, so we built a building and started the permit process.
Yeah, I'm wondering, you know, anytime you're dealing with alcohol, there's got to be a certain set of regulations and that you have to meet. How complicated was it getting a distillery up and running?
Oh, it was very. It took us almost a year to go through all the paperwork. We started out with the TTB, which is the Fed. And then you go to the formula process and then the label process, and then you have to go to the state.
Well, let me ask the same question over to Jesse Williams. Jesse, how did you get started?
It came across as a kind of a business plan that my brother had put together for actually a brewery. He did a lot of craft brewing at home, and we had both kind of looked at it and played around here and there with the brewing side, which is very easy to do at home. And it come to a business decision that it's not exactly a good business to get into at this point. It's kind of at a plateau point with the country.
The brewing business, that is.
Yes, the craft brewing side of it. So we kind of looked at distilling, and we both like to drink bourbon, so we kind of went to that side of it and ran with it.
Okay, and so you're in a facility in East Peoria. Is it a new building or was it an existing building?
It's an existing building. We did a lot of build out within the building to make it work to our needs.
And what about you, Ernie? Are you working with a new facility or an existing one?
Yeah, we build our facility.
Okay, and I'm just wondering, as far as complexity in getting this done, Clay Risen was talking about some of the real craft knowledge and artistry that seems to be needed that can really make for a lot of variety in whiskey. How tricky is making whiskey?
Well, actually, right now we produce rum. We're actually in the process of producing a corn whiskey, but we haven't quite got our recipe together. And we're working with the beer club here locally in town, a couple guys that are craft brewers in the club.
There's a beer club in town.
Yeah.
And with that, you have a rum that you're selling right now?
Yes. We have actually five products we're selling right now.
What is there a particular brand that you work under? Just Rumshine?
Rumshine is our brand.
And Mr. Williams, for you, what are you making at this point?
We make a virgin corn whiskey, and we also make an apple pie version of that and a lemon. And we have a limited quantity of a peach that we still have left in-house, which is a seasonal product. And we've got bourbon that's aging in the barrels now.
Tell me about the recipe. You said a virgin whiskey?
Yes, it's a clear spirit. It's unaged. And that is Our grain bill would be 80% corn, 10% wheat, and 10% malted barley. It is that much corn in a mash bill is a very, very tricky and complex cooking process. It takes a lot of patience because corn is a very stubborn grain to cook the starches.
Now, I understand that this is sort of a family recipe.
Yes, we had already had the business venture pretty much set in stone as what we were going to do, and we had been working on it for well over a year and a half with the planning of everything, and we were talking to my grandfather, which is my dad's father, and he said, well, did you guys know that your great-great-grandfather worked in Peoria in the distilling industry? No, we didn't know this. We had no clue of it. And then he passed on the information that great-grandfather J.K. had eventually lost his job along with most of the others that worked in the distilling industry pre-prohibition, and he went to the backwoods of Macon moonshine to support his family. He had six kids at the time and had to make do.
So this is the moonshine, the Williams moonshine recipe?
It's the same grain bill. We obviously do a different cooking procedure than what they did back in the woods, and we don't have the same still. The most of the information that was passed on to us was the grain bill that he used and a few of the little tidbit secrets, but a lot of it's been lost in translation.
It sounds like maybe the fact that you had an ancestor who was making prohibition era alcohol was not something the family was anxious to talk about much.
No, it wasn't talked about. Grandpa still he told us what he knows, but he said he hadn't really spoke a word of it to anybody before that. It was something that his dad passed to him shortly before he had passed away, and he was told, you don't talk about this. It's just something we don't discuss. So he thought it was worthy to pass on to us knowing what we were getting into, which we're greatly appreciative of him doing that.
Well, that's very interesting. And, of course, listening to Clay Risen earlier in the show, who prefers the aged product, what would you say is the difference between something that is aged and something that is not aged?
You get a different complexity of flavors, there's no doubt. A barrel does help a product evolve in its taste. The wood does add a whole different flavor characteristic to a product. Our corn whiskey is very strong. With the corn flavor of it, our distillation process provides us a very good product. We've been extremely happy with how everything has turned out.
Now, in the case of Ernie, your product, you're making rum right now, and for the uninitiated, what's the difference between rum and whiskey?
Rum, we make it out of a sweetener. We use honey, sugar, molasses, different syrups. One of our products is distilled from wildflower honey, and it's 80 proof clear. And then we also use oak, but we use oak cubes. And then we put a light toasted Hungarian oak cube into the wildflower honey after we've distilled it, and it gives it a flavor and a color.
So these are all specific things, like using wildflower honey instead of some other sort of honey.
Yes.
Really makes a difference in the final product here.
Yes, the wildflower is about the best out there.
Well, once you have the product, then the challenge is getting it to customers. I take it both you, Ernie, and you, Jesse, are selling it at your own facility. Are you distributing any further than that?
Well, we actually had a small-town distributor that wasn't doing his job, and we fired him yesterday. So we're talking Orange and Blue now about them picking us up. But, yeah, we do sell out of our store, and we're out of our distillery, and we do a pretty good job out of our distillery.
When you talk about distribution, are you talking over to packaged liquor stores or perhaps also being served in bars and taverns?
Both. We're right now currently in liquor stores and bars selectively around Tilton and Danville.
Jesse, how about you out there in East Peoria?
Yes, we sell at our retail location here, and we're also connected through a distributor that covers 17 counties through central Illinois, basically from state line to state line, Indiana to Iowa, Missouri.
So your product, would it all say J.K. Williams on it?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And so it's being both in taverns and in liquor stores?
Yes, sir.
How has business, it's been, you both opened in October, so that's really like 4 months. How has business been so far? Let me start with you, Jesse.
Business has been good. This tends to be the slower time for liquor sales, just after Christmas and before the springtime. It's pretty much a trend through the whole country, but business has been good. Our distribution has been steady and growing every week or so. So I'd say we're happy with the way things are going at this point.
Ernie, how's it been going for you?
It's been going great for us. We're really a really small facility, and we've been doing really well just out our front doors. So we really think that once we get, you know, a real distributor, we'll really take off.
I'm wondering, who do you think is buying your product? Obviously, there's no shortage of whiskey and rum out there if you just want to buy whiskey and rum. Are people coming maybe partly because you are local, are they coming because you have a particular flavor that's attracting people?
It's both. We have people come in that, you know, we didn't know you was here. What are you doing? And then they'll buy. And then we have other people come and say, you know, well, we get moonshine from Kentucky, and we heard you guys was here, and we'd like to try your product. And so it's a wide variety of people, young and old both. Really, the older tend to like the stronger, you know, that we have.
The older like the stronger stuff?
Yeah.
That's because of the taste, or just because they like the kick, or what?
A little of both, I would assume.
Mm-hmm. Jesse, how's it been with you, especially in a town which has a distilling history like Peoria?
We get a wide variety of everybody that comes through the door. We get a lot of the younger crowd, the 21 to 27 market, and on up through the 50 to 60 age bracket. So I wouldn't really say that there's a huge lean either way to the younger or the older generations. I think everybody in the area is just curious to see what we're doing and how we're doing it and taste the product. Our reception has been extremely well with the Peoria market.
Now, how many different products do you have right now? Is it just the virgin whiskey, or are there others as well?
We have four products that we sell out of our retail location. We have three products that are out to distribution. Our peach is the only thing we didn't send to distribution due to limited quantities that we produced for a seasonal product.
So those are flavored whiskeys?
Yes.
And are they the flavored virgin whiskey, or are they something that's been aged a little bit?
No, all of our products come from our base corn whiskey, and then we proof it down to a lower proof to make our fruit products.
Okay.
It's all made with a natural fruit and spice.
Do you plan to produce an aged product? It's hard to do right off at the beginning since you've only been open a few months, but
yes.
Is that something you see in the future?
Yes, we've got 10 barrels that are full right now. We have 30-gallon barrels from a cooperage out of Minnesota called Black Swan, and we use a patented design that she has come up with that's called a honeycomb. And we're going to have a six-month aged product, and then we plan to have a traditional two-year aged bourbon.
And your plans for future product, Ernie, in Tilton?
We're working right now on a spice rum from molasses. And then, like I said, we are working on our own corn recipe of our own. And we have an iced tea, and we also have a lemonade.
Well, we're talking about whiskey with a couple of whiskey distillers in Central Illinois here on Focus. Still time for your questions and comments for Ernie Trinkle of Rumsheim Distilling in Tilton and Jesse Williams of J.K. Williams Distilling in East Peoria. Our number, 1-800-222-9455. Our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm struck with, in both your cases, I don't think any of you have given up your day jobs yet.
No.
So both Jesse and Ernie must both be really busy people at this time.
I have actually given up my day job. I am full-time here at the distillery. I work, it's 6 to 7 days a week. I mean, with owning your own business, it is a nonstop business mind. You don't just separate yourself from it by any means. I came on at the 1st of December, and we've been busy ever since.
Jesse, for you, do you Ernie, do you see a time when you're going to move to this full time, or is it always, do you always want it to be a sideline for
you? Oh, no, we definitely plan on going full time. It just depends as how business picks up, you know. We'll drop off on the construction and do more on the distilling. This is definitely what we want to do full time.
You're making a product. I'm struck by just the idea that this is all your own. If it's good or bad, it's because you did it. That must be just part of the appeal.
Oh yeah, yeah, and you know, we strive not to put that product out until we have it exactly the way we want it, and we feel we've done that with the five that we have, and we're going to do that with all future products.
What's been the biggest challenge scaling up from the product you used to make at home to the product that you're now making commercially? How do you just make this work?
Well, we're a very small craft distillery, so it's really not too hard. You know, when we run a batch, we come out with about 8 gallons of 170 proof, and then we proof it down and we make our products. So we don't do anything by a large batch right at the moment.
You're making you're essentially, you don't go to school for this sort of thing.
I didn't know.
And how much does it cost to get the equipment together, that sort of thing?
I actually built my first still, and then me and my partner built our second still. So we did it all ourselves. So copper's pretty expensive, but other than that.
Jesse Williams, maybe you can talk about it from your end when you're experimenting and coming up with something new, working on a recipe. How chancy a process is that you're going to come up with something that you want?
Well, for our new product developments, it can be tricky, and I'm sure that Ernie's experienced the same thing. When you do testing on a new product, you're doing it in a much smaller scale, so your documentation and notes on precise measurements are pretty key to making sure your flavor consistency goes to when you go to doing a full-scale batch, whether it, you know, with Ernie, it's 8 gallons of distillate, and we're about double that for our corn whiskey. So it's not much difference on our end. It takes a lot of notes, and the memory can slip you very easy if you don't write it down.
Have you had to go back sometimes and recheck to make sure were there cases when something didn't come out the way you thought it was supposed to come out?
There's been a few times where we question ourselves and we go back and check all our notes, and sure enough we're right, or sure enough we're wrong. It does happen. Certain things happen, you know, if you're on municipal water changes through the year. So there's minor variables that can make a big difference, and really fast.
That's something that comes to mind. First of all, I wanted to catch a phrase I thought I heard a moment ago, to proof something down. What does that mean in the process, in the liquor making process? I thought I heard the phrase.
With proofing a product, you take your initial proof, and use most small distillers use hydrometers. We don't have the money for the fancy equipment that the federal government uses, but you use a hydrometer and it takes the gravity of the product and tells you what the percentage of alcohol and the percentage of water is in it. And to proof it down, you actually add water to lower the percentage of alcohol, the proof of the product.
Okay. The water you just mentioned, that you're using the municipal water in East Peoria, and I would imagine that water would be really key in this process. You're using the municipal chlorinated water, the regular treated water, and does that affect flavor in any way?
We use a regular municipal water on our mash, and then for all of our proofing, we use a reverse osmosis system to proof the product, so we still keep the full flavor of the product and not changing it with the municipal water.
Ernie, with Rumshine over in Silton, where do you get your water from?
When we make our mash, we use municipal water, but when we proof ours down, we use distilled water. So we get a very clean water, as he does, and we keep our flavors too.
And that's something that's really important. If you use tap water, you would notice it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, depending on what minerals are in the water, you know, and flavors and everything else.
Well, we're running out of time here on the program today, but I wanted to thank both of you for being on the show. If you go to will.illinois.edu/focus, you'll come to links for both the Rumshine Distilling and J.K. Williams Distillery to find out more about their products. You'll also find a link for Clay Risen's book, American Whiskey, Bourbon, and Rye. Ernie Trinkle and Jesse Williams, thank you both for being on the program today.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
And thanks for everyone who called or emailed their questions. Our apologies if we weren't able to get you onto the air. Focus is produced by Lindsay Moon. Our technical director is Jason Croft, and Ryan Weber is our intern. Coming up on tomorrow's edition of Focus, Spurlock Museum is holding its biannual preservation emporium this weekend. We'll have a preview with some guests who can answer your questions about preserving family heirlooms. Whether it's a book or photo album, maybe an old one-of-a-kind recording, or objects ranging from artwork to clothing, or anything, call and email your preservation questions on Wednesday's show. Remember, Focus is live each weekday morning at 10 with a replay at 8 p.m. You can hear Focus over the air on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu, where you can also listen to past programs and sign up for our free downloadable podcast. That's at will.illinois.edu/focus. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL.